Welcome, Serious Eaters, to a special Thanksgiving Ask Special Sauce. Serious Eaters from all over have sent us Turkey Day-related questions that they would like us to answer. What we're really trying to do here is take the stress and worry out of Thanksgiving. Here to do the answering and provide the stress reduction are two people who know a thing or two about cooking and baking. Serious Eats' Kenji Lopez-Alt, the best-selling author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, and Stella Park, Serious Eats' resident pastry wizard, and also a New York Times best-selling author for her book, Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts. Welcome to our special Thanksgiving episode of Ask Special Sauce, Kenji and Stella.
Thanks, Ed.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. So, like, what's up, Kenji? I haven't spoken to you in a while. You've been sharing some of your favorite books with the Serious Eats community and doing your usual arguing with people about the merits of brining and extolling the virtues of cooking a spatchcock turkey. I know you're supposed to be working on your next book, but I know you're really just hanging out with your adorable daughter. What have you been up to? What are your days really like?
My days are mostly hanging out with my adorable daughter. She's 8.5 months old now. I'm a full-time stay-at-home dad now. Although she goes to daycare 2 days a week, which is when I'm supposedly working on my book. Although really those 2 days are basically spent catching up on emails and stuff like that.
We are not going to tell your editor that.
So there's actually a fair amount of downtime where I do get to do a little bit of work during her naps and stuff like that.
Well, that's good. And so you're working on the new book, which you say in your social feeds has 10% more science.
Yes, 10% more science, carefully measured. The new book, it's a sequel to Food Lab, untitled as of now. But it's going to be focused more on strategies for sort of everyday cooking. So instead of taking 3 days to make a meatloaf, it's going to teach you how you can make a meatloaf on a Tuesday night and have it taste about 90% as good as one that takes 3 days to make.
I like that. I like that. And Stella, you've been making waves on Serious Eats with some pastry heresy, in my opinion, by promoting substituting pumpkin layer cake for pie. That is heresy in my book.
I'm just, team cake needs some love.
But you've also been out on the road promoting your book. Where have you been?
I feel like I've been everywhere. I got to go see Kenji in San Mateo and hit up everything in the Bay Area. And then we went up to Seattle for a little bit and then on to Boston. And I've been to Atlanta and Cincinnati and I've done events in New York, of course. And I've got more events coming up. And it's been pretty crazy.
You're a true road warrior.
Yeah, I'm definitely getting some new luggage.
So, all right, we have many questions. People were really interested in getting the two of your take on their Thanksgiving problems and opportunities to solve those problems. So we're going to start with two people who, Drew C. and Christina Y. And basically, they're both asking about time and space management when cooking for the holidays. One of them, Drew C., goes to his in-laws for Thanksgiving. It's a 9-hour drive, South Dakota to Colorado, with a 2-year-old and a 7-month-old, so we make the drive at night to keep everyone sane. We're leaving Tuesday evening after work. It will be a pretty hectic weekend with all these people in the same house. We would like to be able to contribute somebody to the meal Thursday, but don't want to use any more kitchen resources than necessary the day of. Do you have recommendations for something that we could make before we go and is easy to prepare or reheat? And Christina Y. basically has the same theme to her question. Keeping things warm is our biggest challenge. We only have one oven and there are always a bunch of sides. So how do people deal with this? I have the same problem. So I really hope you can answer Drew C.'s and Christina Y.'s questions.
Yeah. I guess I'll go first. This seems like more of a sort of savory related question, although I'm sure there are some dessert options that Stella can recommend too. Well, for Christina, who's asking about something that she can make and bring on a 9-hour drive without having to do much work once she gets there, I would say make a good salad. You know, I think salads are definitely sort of underrepresented and not thought about enough during Thanksgiving meals, because everyone thinks about the stuffing and the potatoes and the turkey. But a good salad, I think, makes an excellent side. I would say on Serious Eats, we have a recipe for a warm Brussels sprout salad, which is essentially, you know, you can do a lot of that prep ahead of time. It's Brussels sprout leaves that are sauteed in a little bit of bacon fat, and then have a sort of hazelnut, a toasted hazelnut vinaigrette. You can make basically all of those elements in advance. So you can even cook off the bacon lardon and just save the fat, separate all the leaves on the Brussels sprout leaves, put them in a Ziploc bag, and then completely make the toasted hazelnut vinaigrette. So when you get there, basically all you need to do is reheat that bacon fat in a skillet, add the Brussels sprout leaves and saute them, and then just toss everything together. Or if you want to do zero prep when you get there, zero heating when you get there, there's a recipe on Serious Eats also for a roasted squash salad with cranberries and kale. And for that one, all you'd have to do, it's served at room temperature, so all you'd really have to do is roast the squash ahead of time and make the dressing, get your greens ready, and then you can just pack everything up. And when you get there, all you got to do is toss it all together. And so, you know, it's really easy to do. They're both delicious, and very, very little last minute prep on those.
And what do you do if you don't want to use bacon in the Brussels sprouts? What can you substitute?
Oh, well, you don't have to use bacon. You can saute them in olive oil. You can saute them in butter if you'd like as well. Although, actually, since it's being served room temperature, I probably wouldn't recommend butter because it would chill and sort of turn waxy. You can use olive oil. No problem.
And Stella, what are the challenges in terms of having one oven or traveling with dessert?
You know, it's not quite as challenging as you might expect. Most layer cakes in particular do extremely well on the road. So you can make up a layer cake in advance and just refrigerate it overnight before you hit the road. And the butter will harden and it'll be good to go for, you know, 6 to 8 hours after you take it out of the fridge, as long as you have it in a box or something where it's protected from anything in the car that might fall on it. Layer cakes are super sturdy, and you know, when you get back to your destination, you can pop it in the fridge to kind of extend the shelf life a few days, or you can leave it at room temperature. And especially with my cake recipes, the way they're formulated, they have a little bit more sugar than some, and that helps extend their shelf life. So they're great for a couple days at room temperature.
And I think this is just your way of getting back at me, Stella, because you're really recommending the pumpkin layer cake on the site.
Well, you know, I can also recommend pies with no reservations. For all of my custard-style pies, I fully bake the bottom crust. I don't do any par-baking nonsense. I'm kind of like all or nothing. So you get this like super crispy, flaky pastry crust that's really resilient to moisture absorption. And that's great, too. My pumpkin pie, my cherry pie, some options like that keep crispy for several days. As you can attest, you've had leftovers of both, I believe, at this point.
I believe we had them very briefly before they ended up down the hatch.
Yeah, so they last. It's kind of just choosing the right recipe that might have some keeping qualities, which I will say a lot of my recipes are designed that way. From my background in restaurants where, you know, I was a one-woman pastry show, so I had to kind of make things that could keep around and didn't, you know, have the resources to be making literally everything from scratch every single day, you know, day in, day out. It was really important for me to have some things that could be held. So my recipes definitely have that kind of long shelf life bent.
Yeah, you know, Stella talking about restaurants, that reminds me sort of one of my sort of perennial Thanksgiving tips, which is to sort of think about it as if you're at a restaurant. So when you have a... When you're in a restaurant, there's a number of different stations in the kitchen. So there, you know, there might be a guy on doing things in saute pans, somebody on the grill, somebody doing salads, somebody at the fryer. And when you design a menu for a restaurant, you have to sort of make sure that all of the dishes are balanced between those stations so that one guy doesn't or one girl doesn't get slammed the whole night. And I like to think about sort of big meals, Thanksgiving, Christmas dinner, things like that, in that same way. So think about all the various heat sources you have in your kitchen. In an average kitchen, you probably have at least an oven, you have a burners, you have your four burners on your stove, you probably have a microwave, and you might even have a toaster oven. So think about using all of those different heat sources and sort of planning your menu so that not everything comes out of the oven or not everything comes off the stovetop. So for instance, you know, you could be doing your turkey and your stuffing inside the oven. Meanwhile, you could be doing that warm Brussels sprout salad, which takes a saute pan on the stovetop. You can make your mashed potatoes or say your mashed sweet potatoes ahead of time. And to reheat those, you can reheat, they actually reheat really well in the microwave. Alternatively, you could put them inside plastic bags or Ziploc bags or vacuum seal bags and reheat them in a pot of hot water off to the side. And then you could also be, say, doing some of your appetizers, making some toasts for, you know, if say you're serving cheese and or pate or something, you can be making your toast in your toaster oven. So really sort of balancing your meal between all the different sort of heat sources and remembering all the different tools you have at your disposal in your oven, I think is really the key to managing space. So, you know, even in a small sort of galley style New York apartment kitchen, you know, by doing that, you can still sort of easily serve 8 to 12 people without really crowding up any one of those appliances.
That's interesting. And Stella, where do you come out on the, do pies have to be reheated? Because that's always an issue for me.
I mean, you certainly can if you want to, especially if, you know, you're sitting down and have Thanksgiving dinner and you're not going to like immediately start shoveling pie into your face as soon as like the last bite of turkey has been cleared away. So at that point, your oven has made itself available again and you can kind of warm up your pies in the oven after the meal and not have to deal with any kind of resource management there.
Wait, do you guys actually like your pies? Because I'm a pretty firm believer in room temperature apple pie and pumpkin pie. Are either one of you actually proponents of warm pies?
Warm pumpkin pie, I think, is a crime against nature.
Yeah, no, I don't actually recommend warming them, but just like if you pop them in the oven for long enough that the crust starts to warm up, that'll bring a lot of life back to it, but definitely not long enough that the filling is actually being warmed. I just kind of do that to restore some freshness in the crust.
Mm-hmm. And that's what always happens to me, actually, Kenji, is that I put them in too long because Estella says I tend to put the pies in when we sit down to eat and then I forget about them. The filling ends up boiling and everything gets steamed.
You know what doesn't boil, Ed?
Yeah, we don't want that.
Pumpkin cakes don't boil.
You guys are really double-teaming me on this pumpkin cake thing.
I mean, cake's pretty great.
All right, let's move on. Peter B. has a question about defining terms. Mm-hmm. He says stuffing is basically put inside a turkey. Think stuffed dressing is made outside the turkey. Think casserole. I've always thought the stuffing tastes better. It's wetter, more flavorful, mummified. Wow. I've
never mummified.
Stuffing called mummified.
It's getting dark in here.
Two questions. Is it safe to continue to prefer my stuffing? And can we make dressing that tastes and feels more like stuffing?
Well, first of all, the difference between stuffing and dressing, I think partly it's whether it's stuffed inside or whether it's a casserole. I think it's also just a regional thing because where I came from in the Northeast, everything is like dressing was not a thing. Dressing was what you put on your salad. Stuffing, whether it was in a casserole or inside the turkey is what we called it. I think in the South, they probably make that differentiation more. I'm sure Stella can confirm or deny that. First let's talk about safety. If you're making your stuffing inside a turkey, this can actually be a problem because you're cooking your turkey I recommend cooking turkey breast to around 150 degrees. The government says 165. I say 150 if you want it to be juicy. But since the stuffing is all the way inside that turkey, if you put the stuffing into a cold turkey and you put the stuffing in cold and you throw it in the oven, the stuffing is not actually ever going to come up to the same temperature as the turkey. It's going to always be a little bit cooler. And this can be trouble because the raw turkey juices can get into that stuffing. And then when you're roasting it, you end up with some of those raw turkey juices in the stuffing even after the turkey is fully cooked. So that can be a little bit dangerous. What I recommend is to, if you really want a stuffed turkey, what I do is I take some cheesecloth and I shove it inside the turkey cavity, sort of line the inside cavity with that cheesecloth, then fill it up with stuffing, tie the end off, and then pull the whole thing out so that I have this sort of, you basically take sort of like a cast of the inside of the turkey out of cheese, out of stuffing wrapped in cheesecloth. You can then microwave it or roast it in the oven, and then while it's still hot, put it right back inside the turkey. Wear gloves, it'll be hot, and put it back inside the turkey. And that way, it sort of gets a head start on cooking. And so by the time the turkey is done cooking, the stuffing is also going to be hot enough to be safe.
Can you finish the stuffing in the dryer?
Or in the dishwasher, maybe?
Yeah.
The other thing you can do is roast the stuffing inside the turkey, pull it out, and then cook it afterwards. Spread it out into a casserole dish and then reheat it afterwards while the turkey is resting. That also works. As far as the difference between turkey stuffing that's cooked inside a turkey and stuffing that's cooked outside, and Peter's absolutely right, the stuff that's cooked inside a turkey comes out a lot moister. For me, I like my stuffing to be almost sort of like a savory bread pudding. So very moist and very custardy, and all that sort of texture is amplified when it's inside a turkey. Outside of a turkey, the only way that I know to how to get that really sort of super moist texture is to actually cook it in a slow cooker. And I know people are going to give me flack for this because I'm generally not an advocate of the slow cooker. I think if you're making stews and stuff in it, they don't come out very flavorful. But one of its few really good uses is stuffing. You take your stuffing mixture, you put it in the slow cooker, you cover it, and you cook it on low for a few hours, and it gets a nice crust on the bottom, and it comes out extremely moist. So sort of very similar to the texture that you get inside a turkey. And of course, you can always, if you're roasting your turkey, you have all those pan drippings. You can divide those, so use some of them for the gravy and then pour the rest on top of the stuffing before serving it, and you'll get some of that turkey flavor in there as well.
And Stella, can you confirm the nomenclature for stuffing in the South as dressing?
Kentucky is kind of a borderline state, so I don't know if I have a true Southern perspective, and I'm sure, folks from farther south may disagree, but we treat the terms pretty synonymously. I'm crazy about my dad's stuffing, and it's stuffing. That's what we call it. We've never called it anything else, but it is definitely not made inside of the turkey. We cook it off in a cast iron skillet. But kind of as with any baked item, you can control how much moisture is retained or lost through a variety of methods, so there's no need for it to be dry inherently.
What makes your dad's stuffing so damn good?
Oh man, my dad has the best stuffing. It's insane. It's like super sagey, lots of cornbread, but a little bit of white bread also to kind of offset that texture. There's toasted pecans, there's brown butter. The sage is browned in the butter as it's cooked. It's got plenty of onions. It's got a little bit of a sweetness to it, like this very faint hint of sweetness. And lots of vegetables, lots of celery and onions. And he divides it up into three batches. And there's one that's made with pork sausage. There's one that's plain because I'm allergic to pork. And then he does one, and he does an oyster dressing. And for some reason, it's oyster dressing. It's not oyster stuffing. I don't know why.
See, this gets to Kenji's point. It's very complicated, this nomenclature issue.
Yeah, it is. But I always eat the pork stuffing because it's the best.
the idea of the brown butter in the stuffing, I think that is awesome. I don't know why I've never thought to, because I think I've said in the past that anything that's made with butter can be made better with brown butter. And I can't even imagine why I've never tried that for my stuffing in the past, but I will be doing that this year.
Yeah, it's really tasty.
We should say, and Kenji can confirm this, that even though Stella is allergic to pork, whenever we have sat down to eat with her, wouldn't you agree, Kenji, that she manages to eat at least some of the pork?
She does. I mean, I think Stella's pork allergy is sort of like my stone fruit allergy, where it's like, I'm allergic to stone fruit, but if I'm at the farmer's market and that peach just looks perfect, I'm going to take a couple bites and risk it.
That's exactly what Stella does with pork.
Yeah, it's worth the pain. And I'm also kind of on an 8-hour delay, so it takes until I'm actually digesting it, I guess, for the symptoms to kick in. So usually at that point, I can just like take some Benadryl and sleep it off because I'm a responsible, mature adult.
So when you're on your death row meal, you can order pork safely because you won't have to suffer that 8-hour delay after.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just going to go crazy on it.
That is really a macabre observation.
Well, we already have mummification on the brain from...
That's true. Ever since they came up with a mummified stuffing issue. All right, Gail S. has a question about dietary restrictions. Since there are so many choices during most of Thanksgiving dinner, but there has to be a gluten-free dessert. Can one of the traditional pies, apple, pecan, or pumpkin, have a gluten-free crust? Perhaps a nut crust, and will it still be delicious? And this is a very interesting question because these are two people, Kenji and Stella, who have written extensively on how to make the most seriously delicious crust and pies.
There's no reason for gluten-free desserts not to be as equally delicious as regular desserts. There's a recipe for a gluten-free pie crust on Serious Eats. And when I was doing the photography for, I mean, I wasn't doing the photography, but when I was preparing it for photography by our own Vicky Wasik, we were all like kind of divvying it up afterwards and just devouring this pie. And I forgot to say anything. I wasn't trying to warn anyone. Like, I wouldn't be like, oh, don't get that. It's gluten-free. But I didn't think to say anything. I didn't say anything. And nobody mentioned it. Nobody was like, hey, Stella, this isn't like your regular crust. What's going on? And at that point, everyone at Serious Eats has had my normal pie crust. So they definitely have room for comparison or to ask if something was different. And, you know, nobody ever asked. And then eventually I did say something like, oh, so what'd you guys think about the gluten-free crust? And everyone was like, well, that was gluten-free. I just thought it was your regular crust.
And the fact that nobody could tell the difference is the highest compliment.
I mean, and maybe everyone's being polite. Maybe everyone was like, you know, oh, Stella's off her game today. But I'd like to think that it is actually that tasty. The only caveat to that is it doesn't have the same kind of flexibility or plasticity that a traditional pie dough would. So it doesn't do super well with apple pie because the apples are kind of jagged and craggy enough that when you try and lay the gluten-free crust over the top, it tends to break wherever the apples, you know, the edge of the apple comes to the surface of the crust. So that's a little tricky and can get kind of rough looking, but you know, you can go for like a streusel topping or something instead. But it does great on other fruit pies, double crusted cherry pies, and any kind of lattice or basket weave. As long as it's laying flat, it's in good shape. It just doesn't really like flex to cover that, you know, giant mountain of apples.
So how do you compensate with your gluten-free pie crust for the lack of gluten?
You know, I just use a pretty wide blend of different gluten-free flours. It's kind of like, no one flour is going to be able to take the place and serve all the roles that a traditional wheat flour is able to play. But if you kind of diversify and use a blend of different flours, then, you know, each one of them can contribute, you know, one's pretty good at, you know, moisture absorption and one's pretty good at turning crispy and you kind of like get a good range of flours into the pie crust, you can get some pretty good results. I do use a small pinch of xanthan gum in my gluten-free pie dough, and that helps it be a little bit more cohesive and have a little bit more flexibility.
It's gluten-free flour diversification is the key.
Yeah, and on that note of this person asking about gluten-free desserts, in my cookbook, 80% of the recipes are either suitable for gluten-free because they're gluten-free by nature, like ice creams and candies and things like that. And if not, most of the cakes and cookies have gluten-free variations included after the recipe. So you can, you know, get an adaptation there for just about any recipe in the book. The only ones that don't have gluten-free variations are the yeast-raised doughs. That was just an area where I struggle getting a good result with gluten-free. So I just opted to forego that. But all the cookies, cakes, pies, that kind of stuff, there's gluten-free options there for everybody.
Got it. All right. So Stephen N. wants to know, and this is something that Kenji and I have discussed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Do expensive turkeys actually make a difference? Had some family buy expensive turkey from a farm once, still frozen, but couldn't notice any big difference between these and the typical ones you find on sale around the holidays.
I think we've not only discussed this, I think we've probably done several taste tests on this as well.
Yes.
There's a couple of ways to approach this. The first way is flavor. So expensive doesn't necessarily mean better as far as flavor goes. It's really something that you're going to have to talk to your butcher or talk to the farmer. Heritage breed turkeys are not sort of raised the way that, we're not bred the way sort of modern, you know, Butterballs and Jennie-Os and all the sort of commercial supermarket turkeys are. We're bred to sort of have these extra large breasts and very lean meat. Heritage breed turkeys tend to have smaller breasts and a little bit more connective tissue, a little bit more fat. In taste tests, and I've done these both with you, Ed, and also back when I was at Cooks Illustrated, we used to do blind taste tests on this. And there is definitely a difference in them, especially if you taste them side by side. But of course, not all expensive turkeys are those heritage breed turkeys. Some of them are just your sort of normal run-of-the-mill modern turkeys that happen to be raised in better ways. So that's sort of the second part of the equation here is whether you care about the living conditions of the turkey. You know, modern turkeys, just like most modern farm animals that are raised on large farms, don't have particularly nice lives. And so if you are, you know, if you are someone who cares about the ethics of raising animals or about the way animals are treated while they're alive, then for you, it might be worth spending more money to find a turkey that is raised, you know, maybe pasture raised or at the very least organic, you know, something that that ensures that they have a little bit more space and a little bit more room to do sort of the natural things that turkeys do. For me personally, and for my family, we tend to buy the sort of nicer turkeys just because we do care a little bit about the way the animal was treated while it was alive. As far as getting a heritage breed turkey goes, one that has that sort of the smaller breasts and more connective tissues, the other thing to remember is that they aren't going to be as juicy as, say, you know, a Butterball or a Jennie-O, one of those turkeys that's been injected with brine and one of them those turkeys that have been bred to be tender. You can mitigate that sort of the toughness and dryness by making sure that you use a thermometer and making sure that you don't overcook them. So 150 degrees for the breasts is what I recommend. And the other thing you can do, obviously, is to brine them. And I recommend what I call a dry brine. Some people call it a sort of a light curing. Rather than soaking it in a tub of salt water, which is a traditional brine, a wet brine, I recommend just sort of heavily salting the turkeys. If you're willing to get a little bit more involved with the turkey's anatomy, you can put that salt under the skin by sort of carefully separating the skin from the meat through the bottom cavity and get the salt underneath there. Rub it sort of generously with salt and let it sit in the fridge for a couple days. And what that does is it breaks down some of the muscle protein so that as it cooks, it doesn't squeeze out as much juice. So by doing that, you can guarantee that even expensive heritage breed turkey that could generally be tougher and drier than a modern turkey, that even those turkeys will come out nice and juicy and they'll have better, more concentrated flavor.
And so what's the sweet spot, Kenji and Stella, for turkeys in terms of price and value? Is it a non-butterball, so it's, you have to spend a little bit more money than a butterball?
I mean, honestly, I think that's a really sort of personal question because everybody has a different set of values as far as how animals are raised goes. Everyone has a sort of places a different value on their dollar. So, you know, I would recommend that you spend, you know, certainly going from a butterball to a sort of free-range turkey is a big step up. From there, if you go further than that, you're mostly sort of going to end up paying for sort of incremental increases in the quality of life and also incremental increases in the flavor. I think at least going from a sort of commercial butterball to something a little bit nicer, that's a big step up. And, you know, it also is a pretty big step up in price, though. Usually they tend to run at least twice as expensive, maybe three times. So, you know, it's really just a question of what you're willing to spend and what your dollar is worth to you and how you feel about sort of these animal rights issues.
And also your farmers. I think that's worth saying. Maybe I'm a bad person. I don't care about the turkeys that much, but I'm really glad to support the local farmers mm-hmm. in the community that I've known through my restaurant work, and they're doing amazing work and trying to make a living in the face of kind of big ag. So for me, it's kind of worth putting my money back in the community rather than, you know, buying something where the proceeds are going to some national conglomerate, God knows where.
All three of us do whatever we can to support our local farmers. And they don't have to be organic farms. They just have to be people who treat their land responsibly and grow whatever they grow responsibly. Mm-hmm. So we got two questions from Claire H. and Julie about what to do with leftover pumpkin puree that's languishing in the fridge. We have mummification. We have languishing. We've got amazing stuff going on this show.
One of the readers, I think it was Julie, was talking about getting away from typical pumpkin breads and muffins and stuff. Just the other night, my husband and I made pizza with some leftover butternut squash puree. We used Kenji's dough, his food processor dough that's in his spicy spring pizza. And we used that and then just put like a really thin layer of this roasted butternut squash puree down that had a little bit of brown butter in it just to kind of loosen it up. And it's a very low moisture puree, so it doesn't kind of, you know, sog out the dough very much. And that was really nice. I really enjoyed it. It was a really tasty way to use up some stuff going around, a little bit savory.
We actually have a pumpkin pizza recipe on the site that uses a pumpkin puree. And yeah, I agree with Saul. I think pumpkin on pizza is actually really delicious. It sounds, I think when you say pumpkin pizza, people have this sort of pumpkin spice idea in their mind and they think of like pumpkin lattes and that would be terrible on pizza. But but if you treat it like it's a savory ingredient, I think it can be really delicious. The other things I would do, making pumpkin pancakes the next morning, I think is delicious. On Serious Eats, we have a sweet potato pancake recipe that uses mashed sweet potatoes. You could easily replace that mashed sweet potato with pumpkin puree, and the recipe would work one for one. And the other thing that I've recently tried, and it was absolutely delicious, was using roasted sweet potato, mashing it up, and using it in place of cheese in a quesadilla. And I got a lot of crap on Twitter for writing about this, but it was really, really delicious. You don't even have to replace the cheese. You can do a mix. You can still add the cheese in there, but mashed pumpkin or mashed sweet potato, mixed with some savory ingredients. So I mixed mine with, a little bit of, shredded chicken, some roasted, hash chilies that were chopped up, a little bit of lime juice, some, chopped cilantro, and then spread that inside a flour tortilla and fold it and fry it like a quesadilla. And it was really, really delicious. And I think, yeah, that would work. A very non-traditional way to use up your pumpkin puree. And I think a really delicious way.
That's cool. All right, the next question is from, there are two people, Nick M. and Robert B., who, not surprisingly, want to know about the intersection of sous vide cooking and Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Are either of you going to use the sous vide technique for cooking any of your Thanksgiving feast?
Absolutely not. Get out of here.
Stella, I thought you loved no sous vide pumpkin cake for you.
Yeah, I'm going to go sous vide a sandwich.
I am more sous vide positive than Stella is. In the past I have done turkey sous vide a couple of years. You know, maybe once every 3 years I'll do that for our Thanksgiving dinner. And it always comes out really nicely. You know, sous vide turkey breast, I think, is really, really delicious. There's a recipe on Serious Eats. I call it sous vide. I call it a turkey porchetta or turchetta. It's basically turkey breast that's butterflied and seasoned the way that a porchetta is seasoned. So with some sage and red pepper flakes and garlic and fennel, and then all rolled up, wrapped in its own skin, cooked sous vide, and then you finish it off by searing it in a skillet. So you get some nice crispy skin and you get these sort of super juicy medallions of turkey meat inside that are very easy to carve and slice. Of course, you don't get the traditional holiday spectacle of the turkey in the middle of the table. But not everyone needs that. I think it can be really delicious. The other thing that sous vide is great for, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, is reheating things, particularly purees. So mashed potatoes, mashed sweet potatoes, things like that. Cook them, you know, you can even cook them a week in advance, put them in a bag, store them in your fridge. And then the day that you're going to, on Thanksgiving Day, you just drop that bag into a cooker set at, you know, say 140, 145 degrees serving temperature. And then you don't have to think about it. And it's just sitting there ready to eat on its own. So whenever your turkey and everything else is ready, you just slice open the bag and, you know, transfer it to a bowl and it's ready to eat. It's a really great way, to, I think, to make those kinds of purees ahead of time.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's also, that means sous vide cooking is great for leftovers.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, if you have leftover turkey meat, even from a roast turkey, sous vide is a great way to, you know, store it in your plastic, store it in a Ziploc bag with the air pressed out, or in a vacuum bag. Makes it very, very easy to reheat, and reheat it without sort of losing any juiciness, because that's one of the difficult parts about reheating any kind of roasted or pan-seared meat, is that when you reheat it again, no matter what method you use, whether it's the oven or say the microwave, you end up losing some juiciness, so it's never as good as it was when you first cooked it. With sous vide, you can reheat without really losing any of the quality, because you're never going to get it hot enough to the point where it's expelling any excess juices again.
So Nick M. wants to know, if he sous vides his protein, what should he do about making killer gravy?
Oh, well, I mean, that's simple. You know, if you're going to cook your turkey sous vide, you're most likely taking the breasts off of the carcass. So you buy yourself a whole turkey, you take the legs and the breasts off, and then you have this entire carcass to work with. So, you know, get a cleaver, chop it up into pieces, throw it on a rim baking sheet, and roast that in the oven. And again, you can do this days in advance. Roast it in the oven until it's nice and brown, and then use that brown carcass along with some brown vegetables to make a stock, and that's going to be the base of your gravy. So, you know, I think it's actually easier to make a gravy when you're cooking turkey sous vide than if you're roasting it, because you're not sort of in that, well, first of all, you have the entire carcass to work with, and you're not sort of in that time crunch that you have on Thanksgiving Day when you're cooking a turkey the traditional way.
Got it. So We're almost out of time here, but Stella, what are you doing for Thanksgiving?
My mother-in-law handles Thanksgiving every year, so every year I just get to kick back and not think about a dang thing.
Does she get uptight that she's cooking for you?
No, not at all. She's super into cooking for everybody. That's one of like her primary ways of showing love for the family is like making a meal for everyone. So she really enjoys it. She does not require any help from me in terms of desserts or breads or any other contributions. We just show up.
Stella, are you like either publicly or in your own head, are you judgy when people serve you dessert?
Of course I'm judging. That's an important caveat, like, because you can't not, right? It's you have this like analytical part of your brain that kicks in that is able to instantly troubleshoot and identify, like, right. Oh, of course, you know, the crumb is a little bit coarse, that means blah blah blah, like, so there's a part that's always like evaluating that's very analytical. But in terms of like judging, looking down on someone or anything like that, absolutely not. I am so grateful for anyone who wants to cook or bake for me. Most people are intimidated by that and don't want to. I don't get a lot of invitations to people's dinner parties, or, you know, people don't bake for me. So I, of course, I'm aware of the qualities of a baked good, but I'm not like judgy.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, because to me, that's actually the worst part of being a, you know, a professional cook or recipe developer or whatever, is that a lot of people are intimidated to invite you for dinner. And I've had people tell me this, that like they don't want to cook for me because they're afraid that their stuff is not going to live up to my expectations. And like it's the frustrating part about being a professional cook, because I, you know, like Stella, like I absolutely love it when people cook for me. And I love going over to other people's houses for dinner. I love going to holidays. And yeah, you know, there is that small part of your head that you can't really turn off, where it's like, oh, maybe I would have added a little more butter to this or whatever. But that doesn't affect your enjoyment at all. And the whole idea of cooking for someone, I think that's sort of the important part, the fact that you're putting time and effort and work into serving other people. And that's, I think, really what makes the holidays and what makes dinner parties and everything special. It's not, you know, the food is, it's great to have great food, but just the idea of sharing food, I think, is more important than the actual food itself for me.
Yeah, to me, Ken, you know, you and I have talked about this, because people say the same thing about inviting me. In fact, my wife says, that's why nobody invites us for dinner, Ed, you know, because they think you're critiquing the food. But we're just so happy to be hanging out with people we love to hang out with.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And that's surprising, because I think you, Ed, are actually like a famously nice critic.
Yeah, exactly.
But you still get it.
I'm a pushover. But I'm an opinionated pushover. Right. All right. So what are you doing for Thanksgiving, Kenji, before we have to wrap up?
Oh, I'm packing up the daughter and the wife, and we're going to visit my sister in Colorado. So we're actually renting a house outside of, she lives in Boulder. We're renting a house a little outside of Boulder, and we're going up for a week. Me and Alicia and Audrey with my parents and my sisters. We'll probably do some fishing. And then we'll be cooking Thanksgiving dinner there.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Actually, it's gonna be Alicia's first fishing trip. Actually, I'll probably pack her, have her on my back, bundled up, because it's really cold there right now. And we'll wade out in the water and maybe do some trout fishing.
And it's her first Thanksgiving.
Oh yeah, yeah, it is, and she is a good eater. A real good eater.
She's a serious eater. She has to be.
Oh my! I mean, she eats almost as much as I do at each meal.
That's pretty funny. All right, now it's time for me to give thanks. First of all, I have to thank Stella and Kenji for hopefully reducing people's stress when it comes to Thanksgiving. And we'd like to thank the Serious Eats community for sending us these awesome questions. And I hope we have succeeded in reducing your Thanksgiving-related stress. And there are so many people that I have to thank concerning special sauce. I'm thankful for everyone who makes the podcast a joy to create. Our producer, Marty Goldenson, our associate producer, Marissa Chen, everyone here at both CDM Studios, and the other Serious Eats special sauce home, the Radio Foundation. And I want to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving. Stella, you, Kenji, your families, the people you love, and may everyone's Turkey Day be filled with lots of seriously delicious food and wine and the sounds of friends and family enjoying each other's company. We'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.